Father, we bless you and we praise you in the name of your Son this morning, Yeshua. Thanking you, Lord, for your faithfulness, your kept promises, Lord, that you fulfill completely and to the uttermost, and that your word is true. Give you praise this morning. Lord, I stand before you totally unworthy to talk about your word, but Father, thank you that in Messiah Yeshua, I am forgiven and made worthy. Lord, we bless your name today and thank you so much. In Yeshua's name, amen.
Amen.
Well, I almost hesitated to talk about this morning because I'm sure, although I wasn't here, but I'm sure that Richard has covered every aspect of the Passover and the Pesach very thoroughly and completely. But I was given a chance last year to spend some time in Tyndale House, which is the third largest New Testament library in the world after Jerusalem and Rome. And so I was there for a month. It's in the city of Cambridge, but it's a wonderful library. And if I could live there, I would. But unfortunately, time and money doesn't allow. But while I was there, I had at my fingertips some marvelous resources and some teachers, some New Testament scholars that it was just wonderful to be able to talk with them and to have them point me in the right direction. So during that time, because I'm looking at all of the festivals, and how Paul uses festival language throughout his epistles, I was able then to have an opportunity to get in some of the early, into the early church. And that has become one of my, focuses. So some of this has come out of that. And it's very exciting because the Lord does fulfill completely and totally in Yeshua the Messiah. And of course, because of the anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism in the early church, a lot of this stuff should just be second nature to all of us by now, 2,000 years after the fact. It's just been totally removed and taken from us. And actually, the very things that should be used to prove Yeshua's messiahship has been, and still is being removed, not only from the Christians, but also from the Jews. It's all got buried and hidden. So I'm just going to go through quickly, not in any way trying to usurp Richard, but maybe hopefully just adding a few things. And if you've heard some of this, please forgive me, because I haven't been here for your seders.
So no worries.
Well, I always think you can't hear it enough. So first of all, there was to be a lamb for a household, and usually 10 people could manage to consume a whole lamb. And if there were smaller groups, they would join together to form a havarim, a group of friends that formed a mishpocha, a family group that would then consume the lamb. And so this whole household of God imagery comes from the Passover, picked up by Paul. Paul talks about the believers being the household of God because there was a lamb for a household. The lamb was originally, in its most ancient setting, before the temple in Jerusalem was built, these observances of Pesach and Matzot and Bikurim were held within the home, were held in the villages where the people lived, very close to their flocks, because they were pastoral and they were shepherds. So it was a very home-centered ceremony. And indeed, it was because of this very fact that after the fall of the temple in 70 AD and the gathering together of the rabbis at Yavne, which is a village in the Galilee, where the rabbis after in 70 and then in 136, when Hadrian forced all the Jews out of Jerusalem, they gathered in Yavne to try and form a continuing Jewish community, because with the center of the cult, and it is called a cult, it's not the cult in the sense that we use today of the cults, but the actual sacrificial cult was centered in Jerusalem. So there was a real danger at that time that at that point, what we now consider Judaism would not have existed. So the leaders of the Jewish community gathered together in Yavne and created what we now know as Rabbinic Judaism. But one of the main things that they were able to do, because of the original home setting for the festivals, and particularly for Passover, they were able to center it once again back into the home. So it was a natural. So so originally, the lamb that was taken, and if we read the instructions in Leviticus, it's a yearling lamb, a lamb of the first year. It was originally the firstborn, because in very ancient times, it was part of a fertility rite. It can be traced back that the firstborn of the flock. And so in a sense, it is a first fruit. And so it was the firstborn lamb of the flock, a yearling lamb. And so we know from Colossians 1:15 that Paul understands that Yeshua is the firstborn of God. And so again, then we get this synchronicity, if you like, of the Passover, the Pesach, being Yeshua perfectly fulfilled in him. Because the word Pesach actually means, it refers just to the lamb only. Now, so once the Passover was centralized in Jerusalem, you now have the problem of coming long distances to sacrifice your lamb in Jerusalem at the shrine, at the temple, in the temple courts in Jerusalem. So those who were living far away were permitted to sell their lamb in the town and then purchase a lamb in the temple at Jerusalem. And we see this in Deuteronomy 14:25-26. So rather than carry the lamb all the way, say, from Tiberias in the north, which some of you have been there, it's just a long, dry, arduous journey and would have been made even more so on foot and by donkey. You didn't have to carry a lamb. You sold it. You took that money. And there were lambs available for purchase in the temple for your particular family lamb. But it's very interesting because Yeshua was purchased in the temple by some of the Pharisees for 30 pieces of silver to Judas, who sold him. So there's a remarkable picture even in that little detail. The lamb was provided by the king during major periods of reform. And in 2 Chronicles 30:24 and 2 Chronicles 35:36, we see the kings, I believe it's Hezekiah and Josiah, purchasing the lambs for the people, giving a lamb, supplying the lambs for the people. Yahweh, King of the universe, has provided Yeshua, the Passover lamb, who takes away the sin of the world. So again, we get this rather interesting synchronization of facts. It is also very interesting that in the scriptures, and we mentioned it, I think Daniel mentioned it several weeks ago, that coming into the promised land, Joshua has a Passover. And a scholar named Tamara Prosaic has written, she's an Australian scholar, she's written a book on the Passover, and she notes that every time there was a significant covenant change throughout the Old Testament, or an emphasis on returning to the covenant, there is always a celebration of the Passover. We find it with Joshua. Well, we find it, first of all, of course, with Moses, then with Joshua, then with King Hezekiah, and then with Josiah, and then with Ezra and Nehemiah as the people come back into the land. And so when So there's a picture then established already, a calling back to the people, coming back to God, let's do it the right way, a stress on the keeping of the Torah and a rededication of the people to the Lord, and then a Passover. So when Yeshua is sacrificed and becomes the Passover lamb, it's the fulfillment of all the previous callings back. So we know that the lamb was to be chosen on the 10th of Nisan, or the 10th of Aviv, according to the Torah, which is the month of green ears, and kept in the temple precincts for 4 days to be examined for faults. Yeshua was in the temple, we see from the Synoptic Gospels, for 4 days before Pesach, being questioned and examined by the chief priests and the Pharisees. And we see this particularly in Luke 20 and 21. No fault was found in him. These lambs had to be inspected very carefully to make sure there wasn't a blemish of a defect, a birth defect of any sort, and that it was whole and perfect. And when they were pronounced perfect, they could then be sacrificed as the Pesach. No fault was found in him. Pilate said 3 times, in John 18:38 and 9:4 and 6, I find no fault in this man. It was said to the people. Now Yeshua, because he went in on the 10th of Aviv, Yeshua would have entered with the lambs into Jerusalem. And we know from Josephus, even though he exaggerates, scholars question. They question the scriptures, they question the ancient historians as well. But the scholars suggest that Josephus exaggerated. So if there was 250,000 lambs slaughtered in Jerusalem, that would put the population in Jerusalem at 2,500,000 for the festivals. Now, Jerusalem was geared, its whole finances were geared around the festivals. Because as pilgrim festivals, the Jews were required at least once during their lifetime, if you were outside, to come in. So the whole of Jerusalem's economy was built on the festivals. People were bringing their first fruits money in to Jerusalem, not only to buy the lamb, but they could actually use it to buy food and drink and to make merry, because they were wonderful times. In fact, they were such joyful occasions, and it was so exciting when all of these pilgrims from all over the diaspora came into Jerusalem. The Gentiles would get excited about it. They would want to join in. It looked really appealing. It was a natural tool for conversion, if you like. So 250,000 lambs. Could you imagine the smell, the poop, the noise? Well, that's, yes, I'm going to get to the blood, but just the lambs coming in, the bleeding. This was not I don't know about you, but years ago, I used to have sort of an anesthetic picture of, you know, Jesus coming in and all of the palms waving and the clock. But the thing is that that's not how it was. It was stinky, messy. Yes, it was jubilant, but it was incredibly noisy, dirty, dusty, and sheep smell. So I believe that this is a picture. Yeshua was identifying himself with the lambs. And it's a picture of the nature and the cost of sin. I mean, it's messy. Living is messy. Humanity is messy. He calls us his sheep. Wow. Now, from its inception, the Pesach, referring to the lamb alone, was understood to have a prophylactic effect, a covering effect. The Passover sacrifice was a zebach shelamim, a peace offering. And in its most ancient form, that's what it was. The shepherds would take this lamb and sacrifice it as a peace offering or a communion offering. In other words, it restored a right relationship between God and man. And the blood of the lamb was understood as having this covering effect. And we can see from that the relation between the Passover and Yom Kippurim, the day of the covering. It's a covering effect. God doesn't look upon our sin, he looks upon the blood. Now the blood of the lamb in Exodus 12 was painted on the door. Well, it was actually, the word is to strike. It's a violent word in the Hebrew. So there was a lot of blood. It wasn't just daubed nicely on the door. It was actually, with the hyssop, actually struck. So it was splattered with blood. And as we know, it is painted on the top and on the lintels, in effect making the Hebrew letter chet for high. So this blood, this door of covered in blood, actually became a door of life. So normally blood associated with death becomes a door of life. And as they left that next early morning, they were going through a door of death that led to life. So you can see how Yeshua, as the Passover lamb, and his blood and the death of him led to our life. He is the door, because the actual staros, or we call it a cross, it's actually a stake. The word staros in Greek actually means stake. It's not a cross at all. In fact, the poles were generally left into the ground, and there was a groove, like a V groove, cut in the top of the pole. And the prisoner to be executed would have his arms bound or nailed to the crossbar, and then he would be lifted up and dropped into place into the groove in the top. And so here we have a similar picture of Yeshua with his bloody head and his bloody hands, in the sense it forms the shape of a chai, of the letter chai. In John 10:9, Yeshua tells us that he is the door to abundant life. Now, not one bone, and you probably know this already, not one bone of the Passover lamb was to be broken. In Exodus 12:46, rather, Yeshua's bones were left unbroken as he gave up his spirit and died before the soldiers broke the legs of the crucified men to hasten their death. The reason why the legs were broken, some of you may know, some may not, was because a crucifixion was actually a death by drowning. A crucified victim would push upon his legs that were either tied or nailed to the cross in order to be able to breathe. And it took a long time to die. The uniqueness of Yeshua's death was because he died so quickly. And just to go back to Jerusalem, I think it's really important that we understand this whole this scene here. I'm going to talk about Jerusalem in a minute, and well, I'll leave it till then. I'll leave what I'm going to say till then. So, here I am at the point, so it doesn't matter. The Passover lamb by the first century was slaughtered in the temple by huge numbers of Levites called into service for the hundreds of thousands of sacrifices that took place. So I'm going to talk about this because this is a real picture. The sacrifices in the first century had, as I said, the sacrifices, but the festivals had become really popular. And so the estimation of the pilgrims in Jerusalem could easily have reached up to 3 million. Now, Jerusalem is not as big then as it is today, so you can imagine. People who lived there were required to take in pilgrimages. Pilgrims, and to put them up, because you had to live for the time of the festival. You had to live in the environs of Jerusalem. It was limited. At night you had to go home, but you weren't supposed to leave what they considered the environs. It was like a radius, a 4 or 5 mile radius, but which you had to dwell. Probably one of the reasons why Yeshua went to the Mount of Olives, because it was right there after his Seder meal. And so you had people opening their homes to people from all over the world, and they were not allowed to charge money. Very often, as a payment for their room and board, they would give the person who was putting them up the skin of their lamb. That would be a way of paying the people for having them stop with them. But it was such a joyous occasion. People look forward to this. It wasn't onerous to have your house full of people. It was considered a blessing and a mitzvah and a real joy to have people in your home. So how did this comparatively small temple complex manage to slaughter 250,000 lambs all within a short period of time? Now, I'm not talking about the cultic lamb, that one lamb that was slaughtered in the temple by the high priest for the sins of the people, or even as a remembrance of the deliverance from Egypt. I'm talking about 250,000 lambs into the temple courts. Well, the whole of the temple was used. Not the Holy of Holies or the most holy place, but the court of the people and the court of the women and the court of Israel, the court of the women and the court of the Gentiles was all used. And in earlier times, if there had been room, sufficient room for these lambs to be slaughtered in all of these three places, and indeed on the temple walls and into the pillars were embedded iron rings that the lambs of the people could be tied to in order for the ritual of removing the innards for sacrifice to be taken out of. But by the first century, the sheer numbers made this impossible. And indeed, we know from the Talmud that the cycle of the slaughtering of the lambs actually was repeated three times. In the first century, people waited outside and they came in waves. And each time the process was repeated again. All of the 24 courses were brought in of the priests to take part. All of the Levites were taking part. And the singers were on the steps and they sang the Hallel. And the whole repetition, they just kept repeating the songs and psalms of praise while all of this was taking place. So it was quite lengthy. So three times, and the place was packed, and the staves in the wall, the iron hooks in the wall weren't sufficient. So this is how they actually did it. At least two men from a family would come in with their lamb. It would be ritually slaughtered by a shochet with a very sharp blade, and the blood would be drained out of its neck and passed from one Levite, a priest, to another until it got up to the altar where it was then dashed, the blood was then dashed against the altar. Then the two family members, having had the blood removed and the blood offered unto the Lord, then took a pomegranate stave. And the pomegranate stave was pushed through the forearms of the lamb so it would hang like this. And one man would hold one end of the pomegranate on his shoulder like this, and the other man on the other side would hold, so the lamb was then hanging. And this is all from the Talmud, from Tractate Pesachim in the Talmud, in the Babylonian Talmud. And then the person who was doing the opening of the lamb would take, the lamb was flayed. In other words, there was an instrument on which there were cords to which were attached stones, and the lamb, the furry part of the lamb was removed in that manner by being flayed. Well, this we know happened to Yeshua. The Roman guards flayed him with a flagellum, I think it's called, which was like a cat of nine tails or more, which had pieces of iron tied to the end. And we know that he was flayed with that, so much so that probably the skin was completely removed from his back. Furthermore, the soldiers pulled out his beard. This is exactly what was happening. You get the imagery of what was happening to the lamb before it was cut open. After the hair or the wool had been removed from the belly of the lamb, it was then cut open and the entrails were taken out. The fat pieces, the kidney and the heart, were then put on the, not the entrails, but the fat pieces and the kidneys were put onto the fire, as a sweet aroma up to Yahweh, who would smell the offering. And the intestines then, and this is by the first century, the intestines were then taken out and washed in water and wrapped around the head of the lamb as it hung there. Now, by the first century, this had become known as the crowned sacrifice, the Passover lamb. Well, we know Yeshua had a similar imagery with the crown of thorns that was bound around his head. He too was a crowned sacrifice. Now, there were very strict restrictions on how the lamb, and we know from Leviticus that the lamb had to be roasted upright, in an upright position. Now, roasting speaks of the fire of judgment. And the Talmud details the very strict requirements of how this Passover lamb had to be prepared. The reason why a pomegranate stick was put through this way was because the pomegranate was a very hard wood. It is very dry. There isn't much moisture in them. And according to Exodus 12, the lamb had to be roasted. It was not to be boiled, and it was not to be sodden in any way. There had to be no water present because it had to be roasted. So you get the idea that they didn't even want the moisture from the wood coming out in any way to boil the meat of the lamb. It had to be fire. And so this pomegranate steak is through the arms of the lamb, the entrails, intestines washed and wrapped around the head as a crown. And finally, another pomegranate steak was then taken and put through the anus of the sheep, shoved upright through the lamb and up into its head. So now we have a perfect picture of a staros, of an execution steak, mirrored identically by what happened to the Lord. The merciful thing for the lamb was it had died very quickly and a merciful death. Our Messiah didn't have that privilege. The lamb, in this position, was then carried out of the temple by the family. And for the Passover, every year, Jews would build clay ovens. Have any of you have seen the clay ovens at General Vallejo's in Sonoma? There's big clay ovens, I forget what they're called, but it's a kind of baked bread there for the Living History Department. That you light a fire in them and get them really hot, then you pull the fire out and then you put the bread in my case when I was making bread. In Jerusalem, similar clay ovens, temporary clay ovens, they were put up every year for the Passover and they were taken down after the Passover. These were abounded by the thousands over Jerusalem. And the fires would be lit, and then the lambs taken in this position were then taken and roasted in these ovens. And it's very interesting, but I read this detail. They fit about three lambs to an oven for the roasting, which you get yet again another picture of Yeshua and two criminals side by side. So it's a very, as I was reading this in this library, it was like, hasn't anybody noticed this before? This is just phenomenal. So we can see this picture. There is writing by I mentioned it last week, by Justin Martyr. He wrote a polemic against the Jews. A polemic is an attack. It's a very famous writing by Justin Martyr. And in this writing, this in this tract called mine's gone blank. I just said it. The Dialogue with Trypho. It's called The Dialogue with Trypho. But in this, Justin actually mentions the tradition to Trypho during the first century, this tradition of taking the lamb and washing the entrails and wrapping it around his head. The early believers knew this. And here in this work, Dialogue with Trypho, Justin actually says to Trypho, well, wait a minute, how come you don't know he's the Messiah? He was crucified in exactly and was hung in exactly the same way as you kill your Passover lamb, the crown sacrifice. The Greek word he uses is helmet. It means helmet, but the imagery is the same. He's got the intestines on his head, just like Yeshua, the Messiah. And Justin is using this against Trypho, saying, wait a minute, you didn't even see this. We know this, but you haven't even noticed this. I can't believe you don't accept him, Yeshua, as your Messiah. But he was using it in a manner that would attack rather than to try and convince. He just wanted to press his point home. I thought that was amazing when I read that, both in the details from the Talmud and from Dialogue with Trypho. When Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, Messiah, our Pesach, is sacrificed for us, therefore let us keep the feast. He was actually, it's more than just a coincidence that Yeshua was crucified at Passover. He was actually, in every way to the uttermost, I'm sure there's way more, fulfilling the requirement for the Passover lamb, both scripturally and experientially in the cult of the day. I'm sure you already know the fact that the Passover was to be performed at night and in haste. And we know from the gospel accounts that's exactly what happened to the Messiah. He was taken in haste at night, wasn't even given a fair trial, and killed hurriedly. Now, this next detail I have read in a couple of sources. I cannot verify it, but I think it's interesting. At least it can be considered. The Passover lamb was placed on the altar at the hour of the morning sacrifice, at the hour of morning prayer at 9 o'clock, slaughtered between the evenings. The evening part of the day began at 12 noon and finished at 6. So between the evenings is generally agreed by the rabbis to be 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At the same time the Passover lamb on the altar was being slaughtered, Yeshua gave up his spirit. And as the high priest would cut the throat of the lamb, in this couple of sources that I read, he would shout, "It is finished," at the moment of the sacrifice. Of course, Yeshua at 3 o'clock in the afternoon cries out, "It is finished." And as Hebrews tells us, he's both the high priest and the sacrifice. And finally, there is something about the bread and the wine. And we all know about the afikoman, I'm sure. This was added after the first century. And people who have researched this afikoman, the whole ceremony of taking the middle matzah, breaking it, wrapping a portion of it, hiding it, or having the children hide it, and then bringing it back and having it redeemed. There's two different ways of doing it. That this is highly symbolic, and that it was added later than the first century. Very probably suggested that it was a Hebrew believer in the Messiah, or a group of them, who actually had this inserted into the Seder. It was not a cut and dried picture. The more I've been reading, even this week, there was always been, and there always has been, a grassroots movement among Gentile believers in Messiah that came alongside the Jews and chose to celebrate the festivals with them. This is why there was so much legislation down through the centuries trying to stop it. And it was because the so-called church fathers were trying to establish an orthodoxy. But this orthodoxy was very much flavored, as we now know, with pagan rituals, pagan rites, that was distorting the truth. So anything other than that to them became heresy. This is why so many believers had to die as heretics. Now, granted, there were some real heresies that took place. But among that group of people labeled heretics were also groups of believers down through the centuries that refused to give up the biblical holidays, the biblical holy days, the biblical appointed times. So, and even during the first century, you couldn't tell a Jew from a Jewish Christian. They existed side by side for a very long time, and in some areas much longer than others, depending where you were, until the church hierarchies of both Greek Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox, and then the Western Catholics really sought to remove them altogether. But Yahweh has had his witness all the way down. But while I was in this library, I came across a very interesting article by a man called David Daub. He worked at Hebrew University, and he was a Jew. But just because of his writings, if he was a Jew, and he never states that he's a Messianic Jew, but he knows Hebrew so well, and he really is very interested in the New Testament. He's written a lot of books and a lot of articles. So this man is very well accredited. But I came across a little article, He That Cometh, and in a talk given in 1966 to a group of British believers, I presume, under the crypt of St. Paul's Cathedral, he gave a little talk called He That Cometh. And in this talk, and I'm not going to talk very much, but I just think it's very interesting. He says that when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 11, where he writes, for as often, 1 Corinthians 11:26, for as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, this cup, it's this bread and this cup, you proclaim the death of the Lord until he comes. And he, in his article, he states that by the first century, messianic significance had become very strongly attached to and identified with the matzot, or the bread of affliction. In other words, by the first century, as Jews gathered to celebrate their Seder meal, the bread used, the unleavened bread used, had already with it attached a messianic significance. So that when Yeshua picked up the matzah and said, this is my body broken for you, that they would have categorically known that he was saying he was the Messiah. And one of the reasons for this argument, he says, is otherwise it would just seem seem totally incongruous for somebody just to pick up the bread. It would be, although every Jewish family had their Seder and gave an interpretation, that would have just been so incongruous for Yeshua just to have picked up this piece of bread. But he argues, and I have the article, if anybody would like it, I can get it to you. But he argues very strongly that by the first century, with the messianic heightened fervor that had developed by that time, already attached to the bread of affliction was the messianic significance, and that his disciples, those people at the table with him, would have known right away. And when similarly, and he doesn't address this, he has another article on the cup, that when Yeshua picked up that third cup of redemption and said it was his blood, they would automatically have known that he was saying, I am the fulfillment, I am the long-awaited one, the Messiah of Israel, the Messiah of God. Very powerful and a very amazing thing. And the word afikomen, which we now know as a later addition to the Seder, is in Greek, it's the second aortist form of the Greek verb ekonomai, which it actually means I came. I came. That before that, it was understood as the bread of the coming one. And so the development into the afikomen is linked because it's the same verb. So Jews would have understood it pre-Yeshua as the bread of the coming one. And post-Yeshua as the afikomen, I came. In other words, there had been a promise and there had been a fulfillment. It's amazing when you get back into the ancient history of that. And so when Paul, and I mentioned this last week, when Paul says to the Corinthians in chapter 5, therefore let us keep the feast, he was actually picking up that word, that shemur, that to observe and to keep the feast. It's just a very Jewish terminology. And similarly, when Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me, it's the same thing. He's picking up what God told Moses in chapter 12 of Exodus. Remember, the word remember, a zikron. Remember. And so Jesus himself was identifying himself with the Exodus event. In other words, Yahweh had said to Israel, do this in remembrance. Yeshua said the same thing. Do this in remembrance of me. Well, it's just a short thing, but I hope you found it interesting and very exciting. And just looking forward to finding out more from these ancient sources.